All right, Merry Christmas, everyone. Got a big episode here, all five of the Christmas games. We actually did the Twitter NBA show talking about Boston, New York, and of course that Golden State and Cleveland Classic. So we're going to start with that. This is our first time integrating that, so let us know how we did on that. And then about the 50-minute mark or so, we're going to get you to the last three games. That's original content recorded for Dunked On. Our sponsors today, SeatGeek. Use that cap space code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate, and Capital One as well. The Capital One Credit Wise app to check your credit score anytime you want right in the app. All right, without further ado, we'll get you to the simulcast of the Twitter NBA show.
All right, welcome on to a slightly delayed version of the Twitter NBA show. Merry Christmas, everyone. Welcome, replay viewers. Sorry for the brief technical difficulties, but hopefully we'll be in good shape now. A classic between the Cavaliers. I was about to say Spurs and Bulls because that game's been on already for so long.
I don't think that's been a classic so far, but this was a really remarkable game. A lot of different things to go through. For me, the focus was the time when the Warriors were on offense and the Cavaliers were on defense. There were a lot of struggles throughout that fourth quarter, and you have to give credit and blame both ways. The Warriors offense was not executing the way that you expect, but a lot of that credit should go to the Cavs.
Yeah, it should, and I think that Richard Jefferson, although he probably had the best 2-for-11 game anyone will remember, because those two awesome dunks were his only field goals. He was like 0-for-8 on threes or something like that. And then he also locked down Kevin Durant, really got into him. Some would say a foul on the last play as he stepped on his foot, appeared to trip him, but no call was made. And then also I thought that Iman Shumpert was outstanding on Curry, really getting into his body. And the Warriors, just a lot of times they will get a little bit too cute in these situations. They love their off-ball stuff. It can be beautiful, but really down the end of a game when you're trying to run some good stuff, pick and roll could be helpful. Although when they were able to do that and got the ball into Draymond Green's hands, he had 3 turnovers in the period as well, as the Cavs came back with from a 14-point deficit, outscoring the Warriors 29-14 from that point on.
A few of the Warriors passes, particularly Draymond's, were overly ambitious. It was one of those where it was a narrow window, probably wasn't going to get there in the first place. And as you brought up, the idea with the pick and roll is important to remember, because the Warriors have great pick and roll personnel, but it isn't something they'd run very often because they have a lot of ball movement and player movement otherwise, and they rely on that. And particularly with Tron Lue's justifiable decision to play Kevin Love over Tristan Thompson, that is something you would want to exploit, but it isn't really that big a part of the Warriors' DNA.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, both because the Warriors weren't scoring, were turning the ball over. I mean, it was really, other than the end of the game when the Cavaliers were able to have some great shot making, it was really about the possessions in the aggregate in this game. The Warriors were not able to protect the defensive glass, and then they also turned it over 19 turnovers to the Cavaliers 11.
And the end of the game, we'll go through it in more detail, but the end of the game was a testament to the shot creation and ability of Kyrie Irving and to a lesser extent LeBron James. Kyrie was spectacular in that fourth quarter, 14.
Yeah, he was really good. I mean, that lefty hook that he made over Durant was ridiculous. There are times when JaVale McGee tried to guard him earlier in the game, he couldn't do it. It was actually, I mean, it wasn't a good game for Kyrie until really the fourth quarter, and not even really the end of the fourth quarter, because you'll recall it looked like the Warriors had salted this one away. They went on a 7-0 run to put themselves up by 14 very early on during that period when LeBron was out of the game, but then the Cavs were able to claw just a little bit back, and then when LeBron came in, they're able to turbocharge that comeback.
Right, that's exactly the moment that I keyed on in this game, was that I believe the Warriors were up 12-14, something in that range, and the Warriors have actually made it. It's been a difference between this year's team and last year's team, is that there have been moments where it's looked like they would have the ability to just take control of the game and end it, and a lot of times they haven't, through failures to execute, turnovers, missed shots, and there was a lot of both of those. And so I think it was 8 points or so when LeBron came back in, the crowd was back in the game, and then they just took it from there.
It seemed like the Warriors had all the advantages in this game. They, and throughout most of the game, that they really had outplayed Cleveland, but in some of the effort categories, the Warriors dumb turnovers, many of those caused by the Cavs. I mean, a lot of those were steals that the Cavs actually caused, not just throwing the ball out of bounds or traveling or whatever. That was a big part of it to me. But then, you know, the Cavaliers didn't have J.R. Smith, and he's so important to the Cavs, number one for the spacing that he provides, but number two because when they love to run those pick and rolls involving Curry, you really can't just hedge off of Smith because he'll hit a three and burn you. Liggins, Shumpert, even Richard J. Jefferson, they're not going to do that. We saw that a couple of times. And then, you know, you saw Steph play good pick and roll defense and then foul Shumpert. You know, there are a lot of just those kind of little mistakes. And the free throw line, of course, was a huge for the Cavs as well.
This could be a learning experience in a way for both teams. The Cavs get confidence that they were able to beat an excellent team without their best game, which is something Cleveland has done a few times against Toronto. But, you know, against the Warriors, even the finals games, they were playing pretty well and did that. But you're right, the free throw line disparity was significant later. But I think that, you know, I think that the biggest takeaway for me, if I were looking at this game, is just that the Warriors still get in their own way too much, considering their personnel. And if they can hone that into something positive, then we'll have a much more interesting fight.
Yeah, and you would still think that the Warriors would be favorites. They're favorites to get the number one seed. But, I mean, this is another arrow in the quiver for a team that surprisingly really was one of the best clutch teams ever, maybe the best clutch team ever during the regular season, and then even in the playoffs last year as well. They collapsed against the Cavaliers down the stretch in Game 7. They couldn't score again down the stretch in this one. And so those questions are going to get louder as to whether now, you know, there is a mental thing with this Cavaliers team having lost four straight to them at this point.
And do you want to start going through some of the end of the game?
Yeah, I think that'll be fun and get into a little bit of some of the larger themes in this one through the lens of the end of the game. We also are going to talk later about New York and Boston, get into that one. We're going to take Twitter questions from that hashtag Twitter NBA show, and then also your questions on Periscope as well. So feel free to get those in, and we'll get to those also. You can start getting those in now if you want to, and we'll make sure that we see them. I thought that the biggest play of this one, even this is before we even get into the end of the game, that dunk that Kevin Love had. You remember that play? The Warriors were already up 14. The ball bounced out to, you know, about the top of the key. Three Warriors were around it. I forget which Cavalier actually got to the ball and then just threw it to Kevin Love for a wide open dunk. He would have been way behind the play. That could have put the Warriors up 16. That was really a huge play. And then Sean Livingston lost the ball out of bounds. He could have had a wide open dunk on a pass from David West that he probably put a little too much heat on. That really allowed, it looked like the Cavaliers were done. And those two little plays, it just seemed like there are a lot of those where the Warriors were just about ready to get it taken care of, and then Cleveland came back and was able to make some of it.
Some days you just step on a bunch of rakes in a row.
four days in a row in the case of the Warriors recently. So I thought where we'll pick it up here when it was 103-99. Ty Lue, who I thought was brilliant in this game, ran a nice ATO for LeBron James. Actually, a similar concept to what the Warriors like to run their cyclone play, which we saw earlier. They ran that against Detroit where Steph back screens for Draymond. In this case, it was the guy Steph was guarding back screening for LeBron, and the Warriors don't want to switch that because that means Steph on LeBron. And it's all because of that play that Kyrie hit, because of all the foul trouble that Steph was in the finals. They're almost too scared now of getting Steph switched onto those guys. I mean, Steph has got to help on that play with LeBron, even if you're not going to switch it. And Steph was guarding like Shumpert or something. He wasn't guarding someone good necessarily. So, but LeBron got a wide open dunk when Steph just kind of didn't want to get switched onto him, but a nice play from Lue.
Well, and that's one of the secrets kind of these circumstances is you try to hide guys on different players, and you have to be comfortable having actions initialized with different players involved, because some teams you just get into that situation. I've actually seen that sometimes with the Knicks. We talked about it a little bit in the first game, but you know, the Cavs are just sitting there going, okay, if we need to get Curry on LeBron, let's just make it happen.
I thought that Lue also, a risky move that perhaps paid off, was he did not go with Tristan Thompson, who was brilliant in this game, brilliant defensively in the finals. Instead, it was Love closing at center. The Warriors were unable to take advantage of that defensively, except on a couple of plays or on the Warriors' offensive end. And then Love spacing the floor. That's what let Kyrie Irving and LeBron get those layups and dunks late in the game, because they were going with that five-out look.
And some of the Warriors' challenges in that area were kind of forcing the ball defensively, and those things wouldn't have really been different if Tristan Thompson was in the game or if Kevin Love was.
Yeah, so, Thompson is probably a better player than Richard Jefferson. He's probably a better player than Shumpert. But as we discussed, those guys were what were doing it for the Cavaliers defensively, more so maybe than Thompson was, and the Warriors just weren't even able to get all the way to the rim to take advantage of Love's lack of rim protection or take advantage of him in pick and roll either.
Right, and so after the LeBron play that you just talked about, I think the next two sequences, it was a Draymond forced a pass, I think it was from the top of the key, that was just, there was a no chance play. I think there were two Cavs in the way, and then Durant missed a jump shot, is that right?
Yeah, he missed a tough jumper from the top of the key, and that led to Kyrie with that beautiful lefty hook shot after the Warriors actually had great transition defense getting back. Kyrie was guarded by Durant, went into the lane and was able to rim that hook shot in. And after that, it was Kyrie with that beautiful baseline drive on Klay Thompson. And then LeBron, one of the best in the league. They used to run that play with Mo Williams back in the initial iteration of the Cavs, where Mo would drive baseline. They would actually set it up as a set play for LeBron to come down the lane and dunk on people. And he did. Were you aggrieved, if you're a Warriors fan, that that wasn't a technical on LeBron for hanging on the rim?
Yeah, I think you are. I mean, because it wasn't like he was doing it for safety. There is a callback to the Draymond Green.
Who cares?
I don't care. You asked if I were a Warriors fan, okay, what I would do. But I'm fine with that not being called. I was irritated by the Richard Jefferson technical call as well. So Warriors fans, both teams have reasons to have beef with the refs. Maybe Warriors a little bit more, so, but who cares?
Maybe that we should talk about what the actual rule is too. If there are people underneath you or even close to underneath you, you can hang on the rim all you want. It's when you actually like do a chin up on the rim, like Draymond Green did to get the technical about a couple of weeks ago. That's when you actually get called for it. So if you wanted to just hang on the rim with his arms extended, you can do that all day if you just made a dunk, and especially because the foul was called too. I mean, that's the other thing to remember is when a foul is called, you're getting much more of the benefit of the doubt as far as like trying to avoid contact. Play has stopped. You're not slowing down any future action. So, but I mean, like if you're a fan base and you're crying about, oh, he hung on the rim, like, oh yeah, like what did your team do to win the game? Like that you should be rewarded, you know, like complain about your guys not getting foul calls, fine, but just like, oh, we violated some technicality. My team should have won. Like, no, come on.
Also the eternal fun of having two former lawyers talk about the letter of the law versus the intent of the law, which is something that we enjoy doing, and something with flagrant technical fouls as well.
So Steve Kerr went to a timeout at that point, set up that Warriors cyclone play. They did that against the Pistons, caught Andre Drummond. They got Kevin Love with it too, and it works because guys don't want to help off of Steph Curry. Steph sets the screen. He is evolving into a nasty little John Stockton style screener, and Love couldn't get through the screen. I can't remember who was on him, probably Shumpert, but guys are so concerned about staying glued to Curry that Green just gets these late dunks off of those every time, and so that put Golden State up by two.
And that set up what was one of the bigger sequences in the game if the outcome had gone the other way, which was that Kyrie got close to the basket, but because Klay's a little bit longer, Klay Thompson caught up to him, got the block, and then that led to Curry.
Yeah, you'll never see Kyrie get blocked at the rim like that, but especially by a guard. Like, he never gets blocked even by...
He has such a good sense of space and how much he needs, and Klay just got a little bit of a fingertip on it. That was enough, and that led to an ice-cold Steph Curry getting a three in transition and drilling it.
Yeah, and that was... I mean, you felt like it was very similar to the game last year where... or in Game 7, except it was Golden State hitting a three with about a minute left. Normally, I mean, you think, oh, they're only down three, but being up three, you know, your win expectancy is probably 80% or so at that point. Like, it's really hard to come back from down three with only a minute left. You basically only have two possessions. You got to get 3 points, and you got to hope that the other team doesn't score at all. It's a very commanding position, but not for these Warriors against the Cavs.
Well, and then what happened after that, so the Warriors got to stop, and then Iguodala forced the ball a little bit fast to Kevin Durant. Durant did the analogy I made.
Yeah, it was a missed shot, actually. I think the rebound came out pretty far towards half court. And again, this was another case where the Cavaliers beat Golden State to a loose ball. It looked like KD was going to have a dunk, not a good pass.
The analogy I made was to a defensive lineman who tries to pick up a fumble and run it for a touchdown instead of actually falling on the ball, because if Durant had just grabbed it and held
on to
it...
Scoop and score.
Scoop and score doesn't... not if you're one of those... Not if you're a defensive lineman. If you're a linebacker or maybe a secondary guy, you can do it. But Durant tried to make the big play to finish off the game. If he just grabs that ball and just holds onto it, even if he does what Andre Iguodala maybe should do in transition against the Cavs and just holds the ball until he can pass it, the Warriors probably win the game, forces it a little bit, Cavs get the ball back, and then that kind of leads into the rest of it.
Yeah, Kyrie was able to make a driving layup off of that steal. KD was out of the play, behind the play. He was one of the big rim protectors. He was just able to score around Curry, and then the Warriors really waited way too long. Andre Iguodala holding the ball on the right wing for a long time. This was another one of these, oh, we're going to run all this off-ball stuff and really, you know, show how egalitarian we are. Well, yeah, none of those guys got open, and then it was Andre Iguodala with nothing to do. Draymond had to drive and throw it out to Klay in the corner, which at that point, really, it was too late. The shot clock had expired, and that led to Jeff Van Gundy going completely insane. Number one, because, and both the ways I think were unwarranted. Number one, there probably didn't need to be a review. Thompson's shot was clearly, but maybe they needed to figure out at least when the the clock should be set at. But, and always, Ty Lue is getting a free timeout. Generally, timeouts benefit the defense statistically because you can get your best defensive players in. In fact, that's what the Warriors legally, by the way, were able to do because of the shot clock violation. Van Gundy was going crazy about that. I usually like Jeff, but he didn't have it down the end of this one. And that worked well, but they still were able to get just a great shot from Kyrie Irving over Klay Thompson.
Yeah, and great shot is a way of putting it because the defense that Klay played was excellent. Like, he played great defense, and Kyrie just, he's a tough shot maker. That is a big part of why he is a special player in the league, despite not having some traditional point guard pieces in his skill set, and his ability to just create one-on-one. He created one-on-one. He actually didn't get that much separation, but he got enough for himself.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like Klay had him cut off. I mean, that's just an incredibly hard shot. Hard right-hand dribble, and then turning back over your right shoulder on the right side of the floor.
On a larger defender.
Yeah, I mean, and Klay was right there. Like, you can't defend that really any better than he did, and that was just a beautiful shot from Irving to put them up one. And then that Warriors play was to get KD the ball. He tried to be aggressive. I thought it was very interesting, actually, that they were guarding KD down the end with Richard Jefferson rather than LeBron. KD did most of his work, actually, on LeBron. Jefferson was much more successful against him, and whether he fouled him or not, he did succeed on this one.
That could be an analog. I mean, granted, their capabilities are very different, of just that LeBron has more of a comfort level on a guy like Draymond, allows him to be more of a help defender. And yeah, you're giving up something with RJ on Durant, but you're gaining a very different LeBron James.
Yeah, and for RJ, I think it pretty clearly was a foul. He stepped on Durant's foot and tripped him, you know. Yeah. But that is a play that's going to be very difficult for the referees to see. And RJ gave him like a nice little forearm in the back too. But if you're a referee, you're not staring at the foot of one guy stepping onto the foot of another guy. And so that's going to lead to a play like that is when you throw in as well the inherent bias at the end of the game to not make calls. That's how that ended up happening.
And that is why you want to be up by or be within more than a couple points, because if you have more of a lead, then those sorts of things that inevitably happen at the end of game aren't as large of a factor. You know, that you can't have it swing on something like that. However, you know, close game between two talented teams, that is a part of the game, for better or for worse, and I don't think there's a way of eliminating it from the game with the fourth official like it's been rumored or really anything else.
I keep sending in those Periscope questions. We got a good one from GE of Victory. Did the worry of lacking a rim protector return after this game? I wouldn't say so, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, a traditional rim protector against that Cleveland lineup down the end, he's not going to be able to play. He's going to have to guard Kevin Love. There's no one for that rim protector to guard where he can even get into position. Like, they'll just be get threed to death, number one. And number two, KD and Draymond Green are probably the two best rim protectors at their size, or at least, you know, among small forwards and power forward in the league. And then, you know, the Cavaliers generally shot poorly at the rim throughout the vast majority of this game. So no, I wouldn't ascribe really any of this to that.
You talked about the idea of how they couldn't hang with Kevin Love. I think about it more from the opposite end, that they wouldn't be on the floor because the Warriors' offensive lineups are almost undeniable in that combination.
Yeah.
And so
yeah, you're going to play that unnamed rim protector over, like, Andre Iguodala.
Let's say it's Bismack Biyombo or somebody like that, who's a talented guy. You're not going to play Bismack Biyombo over Andre Iguodala, despite being better at that, because they have their best five. You would have a lot of utility from that player throughout the game. You know, that you could, maybe you wouldn't get into those circumstances, but they wouldn't play.
Yeah, it's I think the big problem here, and the underappreciated part of all of this really in the Cavaliers-Warriors matchup, has been the Warriors' offensive end of the floor. This has been one of the great offenses of all time, both last year and this year, and they have gone through some very, very puzzling drought, both at the end of this game and obviously the end of that game seven. Those two games that they got blown out in Cleveland, they couldn't score well enough either in the finals, and even in the second half of that game five as well, they couldn't score either.
Right.
And so that's where the issues are coming from the Warriors' perspective, is that they should be able to light up this Cleveland defense that in general is not good. But Cleveland finds some stuff with their effort, with their switching, and the Warriors have not been able to compensate for that yet in fourth quarter.
So Chess Eugene asked a similar question. I think our answer will be similar, but it's still good to do it. Should the Warriors have kept Weston and put Iguodala on the bench? I mean, because then you're not really dealing with rim protection. It's just a different type of ball movement and defense.
Yeah, who's West going to guard? He's going to guard Kevin Love at the arc. I mean, I do think that Andre, to some extent, is a little bit of a defensive liability. Or I'm sorry, a little bit of an offensive liability. If he's not being guarded and he's not hitting his shot, especially down the end of games, he doesn't really want to take three-pointers in the last 2 minutes. He feels probably a little guilty about it with all the firepower that's on this team. But West means you now can't switch everything defensively. You can't close out on shooters as well. So no, there's no way that West should play playing Overdahl.
They also, one of the takeaways from this game is I thought Durant did a pretty good job on LeBron James. And so maybe in that circumstance, you don't need as much of Iguodala as a one-on-one defender. You need him to spell KD, but you don't need him in that way. And then you can maybe start to think about something even less conventional. The problem is a lot of the other guys that you would consider for the Warriors more on the perimeter side, an Iguodala replacement rather than a totally different thing. Ian Clark and McCaw being the most obvious, they aren't ready for that kind of prime time.
Yeah, actually, Kerr went with Curry and Clark together, not something that I particularly like. There's just, especially when LeBron is on the floor, there's just too many guys you can attack and have a huge size mismatch. You're doubling your problem with these pick and rolls they always put Curry into.
They also both get lost off ball a fair amount, and so the Cavs can just get those guys in situations, particularly if Kyrie's still.
All right, a few more Twitter questions now using that hashtag Twitter NBA show. Robert Antle, what were your biggest takeaways for a potential finals rematch?
For the most part, until the fourth quarter, Kevin Durant looked really good. And I think he provided something that the Cavaliers are it's going to be really hard for them to answer it, because you have to put LeBron in a very different situation than he was for defensively and to a degree offensively. And so Durant was, I think for the most part, he was excellent in this game. And I want to see how that happens in their game on Martin Luther King Day and then moving forward. But that's part of the reason I'm so excited about a potential trilogy rematch.
Yeah, I mean, both teams went all out in this one. I think other than the fact that Smith didn't play, I do think that one takeaway is the Cavs are going to need a little bit more from guys like Jefferson and Shumpert. I mean, they tax Kyrie for 44 minutes, LeBron 40. He'll probably play more in the finals, obviously. I think that what the Cavaliers were able to do on the offensive glass, Thompson and some of their guards, Braun even too, should be very encouraging for them. I mean, I think overall this should be an encouraging game for the Cavaliers, who did not play their best throughout most of the game. What they're able to do defensively, I think the fact that Love was not only able to stay on the floor but play center and not get killed defensively, that was useful. And I do think there's a little bit of a takeaway from the Warriors. We'll return to this point of just, hey, you got to just go at that bad matchup when you have the chance. I mean, this is like, that is annoying basketball to some degree. It's what we saw in the 90s. I'm glad the NBA has generally moved away from that. But going at a bad matchup doesn't just mean, hey, we're going to ISO against guy. It means, hey, we're going to run pick and roll. We're going to try to take advantage of him in other ways. And I think they could be, especially when things bog down, you can always get something if you just have Steph Curry running a pick and roll involving Kevin Love.
Or even just involving Kevin Durant. We haven't seen much of that this year. It was something that I focused on a lot in various outlets before the season. And teams just freak out when you go to that sort of a lineup because there are so many threats. And the other big takeaway for the Cavs is that Stephen Curry was not himself physically during the NBA Finals. Whether or not that was a huge factor in the outcome or not, he had another bad game today, and the Cavs had another good defensive game when Curry was substantially closer to 100%, whatever his current thing.
Yeah, and we got quite a few questions on that issue. I'll see if I can find one real quick that just, so this is from Option Zero. Is it just me, or has Steph been terrible on D all game? That was one. I didn't think he was that bad overall. He had some ugly moments, but I thought he generally executed their scheme of not switching on those small pick and rolls pretty well. He had a couple of nice steals. You know, it's not like the guys that he was guarding, like Shumpert or whatever, were killing him. He did have a couple of bad fouls, but I think we need to talk a little bit more just how Steph Curry is not the same guy at all this year.
Off the dribble, he is a substantially different player, not only in terms of frequency, but in terms of success. And that could be indicative of lack of something physically. It could be something mentally. We don't really know, but it is different. And the longer it persists, the longer you have to wonder, because this is the anomaly. It's not that last year when he dominated off the dribble, that was different. That's part of what made him, the people who like me who argue he's the best shooter of all time, that's a big part of why.
Yeah, and Steph, 15 points, 4 of 11 from the field in this game, also had 3 turnovers, which is not great when you're only taking 11 shots. I mean, I think it really, a lot of it seems to be mental for him at this point, because he's just not playing free and easy the way he did before. I think he views it as the smaller guy, probably the best passer in theory out of Durant and out of Clay, that he's the one who has to get everyone involved more. He's been passing up shots. He's been driving, trying to make all these passes. I thought that while they obviously were kind of clowning around in that Knicks game where they assisted on their first 26 field goals over whatever it was, it's indicative. I mean, Steph Curry never passes up shots. The best shot used to be Steph Curry shooting a three, even if it was contested. That was the whole point of the offense. And now it seems like he'll go for a while without touching it, and then when he does get it, it's trying to make this spectacular play, maybe a little bit too often, whereas trying to make the like semi-spectacular play on the regular is something we don't see see from it.
Another important difference is how many more guys the Warriors are comfortable with initiating or grab and going. And so before, Curry would have the ball in his hands a lot just because Harrison Barnes didn't trust himself with it. And so that gave him more opportunities. And when he had the confidence to pull it off, he would just do that himself.
He has been effective really screening. Like he does have a lot of gravity. He still, I think, probably has the best offensive rating on the team last time I looked. So he's having a positive effect, but you know, he is going to need to score a little bit more at some point. I think, you know, we talked about before the season that I thought he would be the best player on this Warriors team. He just clearly has not been. It's clearly been Kevin Durant, especially when you throw in his defense contract.
So a question from Chester Eugene that we talked about during halftime a little bit. The Cavs aren't the only team that try to rough up Steph, but why do they succeed?
Yeah, it's really becoming puzzling, I think. You know, and there could be a mental component to it at this point. And it's not like these Cavaliers are some great defensive team. I mean, this time, you know, Steph only got 11 shots and they just made him a huge priority. And to some extent, it's the Warriors not being able to take advantage of Steph. It's, I think, the Warriors' plan of using Steph off the ball. The Cavaliers do a great job of dealing with that. And Steve Kerr doesn't want to say, all right, we're just going to put the ball in your hand, Steph, at high pick and roll, or even like let you get a switch and go one-on-one. When they do get the switch, a lot of times Steph will be on the wing, in the corner. You know, he won't be at the top where he actually has room to work. He'll kind of run into guys. We saw that a lot in the finals last year. I mean, so I think part of it is Steph's confidence. Part of it is the Cavs obviously doing a good job with good defenders. And
I think for the Cavs, it's also like kind of an organizational philosophy. Like for them, that's a part of their plan is to rough up Steph on both ends of the floor. Like there was that Richard Jefferson play.
Yeah, it's really the offensive end that other teams can't do it to him the way the Cavs do.
Right, so there was that play where Richard Jefferson, basically Curry was running around a screen and Jefferson just basically bumped him into the photographers. Yeah. And they didn't call it, and yeah, they should call that. But Cleveland has not only has an effort to do that, but also has great personnel for that sort of thing. Players like Iman Shumpert, Richard Jefferson, LeBron himself, they're good at chucking, they're good at making life hard on him. Tristan Thompson also is just a pain to get around.
Sumit M. Periscope says, should have been Andre on Kyrie and KD on LeBron.
I don't think Andre can hold Kyrie.
Too slow.
I mean, Kyrie is a spectacular one-on-one player. The reason Durant can pull it off from time to time is because he moves well and he's so long that he can be behind a play and catch up. But even Kyrie got that hook shot over him, which was incredible.
Yeah, I think Andre's too slow to guard Kyrie one-on-one at this point. Klay is better at that. He's got the quicker feet. Andre also is a better help defender than Klay as well. I do think there's something to be said for KD being on LeBron one-on-one, because I thought the times that LeBron tried to take KD, there were times in his career where he could kill him, but now I think, at least in this game, KD looked very good with his length. You know, he's not going to get overpowered by LeBron just due to the size that he has.
Well, and also, depending on who you put Andre on, if you keep him in those situations, he's such an intuitive help defender that if you can put him near somebody who's around LeBron, he can get strips just because he knows where the ball's going.
Also, I mean, I had people tweeting at me like, oh, Klay, you know, didn't do a good job. They should put someone else on. I'm like, what are you talking about? That was an amazing defense at the end. And a lot of what Kyrie was able to do is in scramble situations. I mean, this is why when it was so difficult, we got asked about, you know, would you rather have Wall or Lowry or Kyrie or Lillard on last time's Twitter NBA show? I mean, I think during the full regular season, Kyrie would probably be last on that list. But going against a team like Golden State, especially because Golden State makes you go one-on-one so often, he is still one of the best one-on-one players in the league. And also, actually, we should say this. He passed in this game probably better than in any high-stakes game I've seen him pass before.
And he's been on a nice little run with that. He had double-digit assists in consecutive games recently, which is something that does not happen a lot with Kyrie.
10 assists and 7 steals in this game, too. You know, I mean, again, he was getting roasted by Klay early on. We talked about that on the halftime show, but he at least was locked in enough to get those steals in the second half. He got a lot of loose balls, too.
Kyrie is definitely a flawed defender, and like that is something that is reasonable to focus on, and it's easy sometimes to see what he can't do, and it's true. You know, like, he isn't great in the way that a lot of other players are, but what he is good at is undeniable, and like, we saw that. To me, the best example in a high-stakes game was Game 5 of the Finals, when he was just absolutely incredible, and we can take a moment to just appreciate this guy is one of the best one-on-one scorers in the league. He's not a perfect passer, and guess what? He plays with LeBron James. Let's appreciate it while we have it.
Jeremy Lin 40, L-Y-N. Does Cleveland have even one trade partner in the league to turn their trade exemptions into a younger backup swingman? And before you answer, to remind people, they have a $9.6 million trade exception from the Anderson Varejao trade last year, in which they also were able to get Channing Frye into a previous exception from Brendan Haywood. And they also have, I think, $2.9 million from Mike Miller. However, those cannot be combined.
And they also have a small one from Sasha Kahn, but they can't really do much with that. The problem for Cleveland in that context is a lack of assets. So Cleveland has this ability to take on a salary. So either you can take on somebody who has a bad contract, and it's hard to find a swingman with a bad contract under $9 million right now because they're so valuable. And the other way to do it would be sweetener, you know, things. And the Cavs don't have much in the way of young players, and they have a lot of picks that were given away, or not given away, that were a part of bigger deals to build this championship team. So it's going to be very hard for them to do that. They're going to be more kind of, I would say, the equivalent of dumpster diving, but they should be looking whenever somebody talented gets waived, and that might actually happen a little bit too.
What about a James Johnson from Miami? Playing okay this year, not the headiest guy, but he's been hitting the three ball. He's switchable. He could maybe guard Durant a little bit. He's on a $4 million deal that expires at the end of this year. Not part of Miami's long-term plan.
If they could get him, absolutely. And the hope with him would be that maybe he would accept a buyout and that he would go through that route. I was actually working on various things. He seemed like an interesting guy for that. A trade would be possible, but again, especially considering the relationships, let's say, involved, they would have to give up something. However, Miami's interesting because they're asset poor too, so anything is helpful to them.
Yeah, but there's obviously, for those types of players, everybody needs wing, and pretty much everybody has more assets than the Cavs. They do have Chetty Osman, who they got when they traded away the pick that became Tyus Jones in the 2015 draft. He's a young wing out of Turkey, but they want to bring him over. He's cheap labor to kind of keep things going. Hasn't developed quite as well as you would have hoped over the last couple of years, but someone who probably has value. And then, you know, your first rounders, if you're the Cavs, really the first one that you can get is going to be, I think, either 2020 or 2021. And your second rounders are worthless because that's like the 60th, 29th pick in the draft for the foreseeable future.
And I think they even have a couple of those that are sent out as well.
So. Yeah, as in various other salary dumps. And then the other thing the Cavs have to do is Mo Williams is making $2 million this year. Chris Anderson is making the minimum, but he is a torn ACL. You basically have a dead roster spot with both of those two guys. The reason they haven't cut them yet is because they want to find a way to trade them and reduce the luxury tax payment. They're paying basically like $4 for every dollar they're paying those guys. And so you're going to need assets as a sweetener there too.
AP, the middleman, asked about Rudy Gay. The problem with Rudy Gay is that he probably won't get bought out because if Sacramento does that, they failed as from an asset management standpoint, because Rudy Gay has value around the league. He's on an expiring contract. They should be able to get something for him, and that
and
team won't want to buy him.
Currently in the eighth seed, they're not going to do anything until they're out of it, which could happen maybe if Portland.
But even then,
they
should get something instead of buying him out. There isn't really a reason for that to happen, even if it's using him as salary in another trade.
Yeah. All right. What else we got here? Let's see. Marco Politakis. If NBA is Rogue One and Warriors are the Empire, what if anything is their hidden weakness? No spoilers here, but what is the Warriors' hidden weakness?
I don't know that they have hidden weaknesses. We already know that they have a propensity to give up offensive rebounds. They're not as zealous about protecting it, and they have just a nasty habit of bad turnovers, forcing the ball when they don't have something. And the Warriors do a great job at moments of making it so they have like a one read play where a player can make a decision, but sometimes they telegraph that a second too early, and so an active defense can just jump that and beat it. LeBron is an amazing guy at that. He had one play like that.
Late game offense. That's what it's been lately for them. We never thought you'd be saying that about them with this great death lineup that they've trotted out there for most of last year. But I mean, it seems like they either get tight or they try to be the opposite of tight and make really like fanciful decisions that don't really work out very well. So that would be it. I mean, down the end of a close game, this team used to be bulletproof. Hasn't been so lately.
And that betrays their defense. Like I talk a lot, for those of you who listen
to
Dunked On.
Because the D is good. They're always going to defend.
Their half-court defense is solid. Like I talk about feedback loops a fair amount on Dunked On. It's one of my favorite things. And the reason for that is because sometimes you think about it as good begats good. So good offense and good defense feed each other. But it can go the other way as well. And the Warriors are generally pretty shaky in transition defense and pretty good in half court defense. So when they give themselves fewer opportunities to maximize what they're good at, especially against like Cleveland, who's great in transition, they just betray their own ability.
Last one on this, we'll talk a little bit about that Nick Boston game in a moment and everyone tune out.
Hey, it was good. Well, it was fun at least.
Yeah. Jimmy Trigger says, does Kevin Love have a chance to make legitimate impact when the finals come around, or will he be played off the floor? I mean, to me, the big thing about Love is if he gets to the foul line, he's effective. If he's not getting to the foul line, then it becomes a little more of an issue.
He also is great at making some small plays that can really help out a team, but you have to do the big stuff first, right? Like he had that beautiful outlet pass because he's one of the best outlet guys in the league to LeBron on a cherry pick. Basically, it was off this weird broken play after the filthy Durant dunk.
Yeah, that's right.
And so like the Warriors didn't get back because Kevin Durant just dunked all over Kevin Love. Kevin Love responds by shooting his chest pass to LeBron on the opposite free throw line, and he's also kind of does some interesting stuff offensively, into screening and getting space for himself. But the big questions are, can the the Warriors, are they ruthless enough to exploit it the way that they did Enes Kanter? And I think back to that Western Conference Finals, Steve Kerr made it a personal mission to get Enes Kanter off the floor as much as humanly possible. He has not done that for Kevin Love, and they're largely similarly flawed players.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we may see a game or two in the finals where Lou elects not to go with Kevin Love, but he's played so well this year.
He's been way better than he was last year, and Lou had confidence in him last year.
Yeah, I think so, and we're able to score pretty well against these guys. I mean, not like he was getting a ton of touches, but just spacing the floor out, they got so much more at the rim, and shots at the rim that they were able to convert, unlike earlier in the game, even though part of that, I think, was just, you know, bad luck missing shots at the rim, even if it were good Warriors contests.
Before we move on to Celtics and Knicks, this is from SeatGeek. Christmas, of course, one of the most popular days in the NBA season. And if you wanted to go get tickets for today, your best choice would have been SeatGeek. SeatGeek pulls together tickets from other ticket buying sites, basically just like Kayak does for plane flights. That's what SeatGeek does for tickets, whether it's sports, music, theater, whatever it is. SeatGeek pulls all those together so you don't have to go to 8 sites, worry that, oh, I didn't go to the 9th, that I might be missing out on a deal. SeatGeek does all the work for you. And that's not the only way that SeatGeek is convenient. The other way is through their deal score technology, where they're able to give a rating to every ticket that's for sale, let you know whether it's a good deal or a bad deal. You don't have to click through every single ticket and compare its location. SeatGeek really is doing that for you. So you can just save a ton of time and a ton of money with SeatGeek, especially when you use that cap space code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate. Go into the settings tab of the free SeatGeek app, click on add a promo code, and enter that cap space code. Easy to remember, we talk about it all the time in the program. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made that first purchase. So just a couple of swipes in SeatGeek. You don't have to enter any CAPTCHA stuff or anything like that. You go in, you use their technology to find the best seats in the area you want to sit. You buy it, and you're done. So much easier than traditional ticket selling websites. That's the free SeatGeek app, and use that cap space code for a $20 rebate.
We ready to talk a little major market Knicks Celtics?
Do you even remember that game at this point?
I do. It was a fascinating game because Boston went back to some of the things that they do well. Early on, they were forcing a bunch of turnovers. And late, one of the stories of this season has been Isaiah Thomas is number 2 in fourth quarter scoring. And he did a fine job for moments of this. It did feel like they were overly reliant on him at certain moments. But again, Boston had enough to get the win.
Yeah, the Knicks, Boston was cruising in this one, and then the Knicks were able to erase a 9-point deficit. I think it was 110-101, and then the Knicks were able to score basically and tie things up within about a 2-minute period, and then Boston was salted the game away after that. I thought Derrick Rose looked good in this one, 10 out of 19 from the field, also actually got to the foul line for 6 attempts, which doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a huge difference for him because he barely gets to the line at all. Had the floater working really well. But the big problem for me with Rose, though, is just he is not a good distributor. He's really on the lower end of point guard in terms of vision.
There are a couple of different ways that a point guard can be successful. They can be the maestro, they can be a scoring guy, kind of like what Kyrie is. The Knicks need someone whose best ability is to create for other people, and ideally isn't like Ricky Rubio, where they can't really do much for themselves, because then you can just exploit that. They have enough offensive weaponry with Melo, with Porzingis, and, you know, depending on whether they play small or big lineups, they can get some benefits there. But Rose isn't particularly well suited for that. I was thinking at various moments in this game about how like some maybe like Holiday would do there, but I wanted to get a little bit on that crazy run. So it was about 2 minutes, but it was actually less than that. It was a minute 18 from the 224 mark to 106. It went from a 9-point lead to 0, and that was a part of a larger 16-3 run, about 3.5.
Yeah, they hit a few threes in that, as you noted, Thomas. They got a little happy with that, and the Celtics, outside of the Warriors, have the second highest percentage of assisted baskets, still like 10% lower than the Warriors are. The Knicks, on the other hand, only had 11 assists in this whole game. And I think, you know, when your point guard takes 19 shots and has 3 assists, that kind of makes things difficult. Carmelo, a guy who is going to set up his own offense more times than not, maybe necessarily in finished plays. The key sequence, though, in this one was after they tied it, an inbounds play by the Celtics. They switched everything. They actually had Noah on Smart at the end of the inbounds. They got it into the wing. That led to an easy post-up up for Horford against a mismatch. They had to double team, threw it out to Smart, wide open three for him. And that three, I think it broke a 111 all tie, and it was kind of the key play. And then the next time down, after an offensive rebound, Avery Bradley with just a brilliant strip of Carmelo Anthony and then got fouled. That put the Celtics up five and basically ended the game.
There was a play early on when Porzingis got matched up on Avery Bradley and Bradley got a strip that ended up kind of swinging that part, like a little bit of that part of the game. And then late, Melo's licking his chops, smaller guy. I mean, Bradley's a hell of a defender, but is small, substantially smaller than Melo. And Bradley just gets his hand in exactly the right place.
Yeah, that's one where you, I mean, granted, you're starting off 25 feet basket on that play, but you probably want to just put your back to goal and kind of back down on Bradley because Carmelo, not a guy who has an unbelievable handle. Well,
and you'll force help too. I mean, yeah. That's just the way it's going to work. If you see one of the best ISO scorers in the league going on your guy, you're going to create a seam just by panic.
And I understand not wanting to give it up and get it back in the post. It can be a difficult entry, but I mean, trying to just like cross up Avery Bradley if you're Carmelo Anthony, probably not going to work. And then, well, this is just part of a larger point. The game was over when you're down five, obviously, with, you know, 30 seconds left or whatever it is. But once again, the quick two, the Knicks went for it. They tried to get it in down five to Porzingis on the left baseline. He got his floater blocked. And again, that's where people go wrong on the math. Number one is, hey, first of all, you're going to need two threes when you're down five because it's not like they're going to miss both free throws. And in fact, Isaiah Thomas hit one, but that was still enough to put him up by four after they eventually got a quick two. And then also your quick two, that first one they tried with Porzingis, it's not automatic. Like people just say, oh, you know, that three-pointer, you got a 30% chance of making it. The two, you get 100% chance of making. No, you got maybe like a 50% chance of making that quick two. And if unless you have just a wide open layup right off the inbounds, you got to at least try something for the three first.
It's your best chance of winning. And then also getting into the idea of make sure you're trying to trap before you foul, which wasn't as much an issue in this game, but still always something.
Well, in a must deny situation, you're down by three and there's 10 seconds left in the game. They left Porzingis in and they left Noah in, put in a bunch of small guys, switch everything and try to deny the inbounds. Well, like Isaiah Thomas just ran right by Porzingis and got the inbounds and then the game was over. He made a free throw.
Along those same lines, when on the play before that, when Porzingis' shot got blocked by Al Horford, Al Horford was helping on that play. And the reason he was able to get over there was because he was on Joakim Noah, and who cares? Like, if you pass the ball to Noah, maybe he's going to make that shot. Maybe he's going to, you know, he's going to alligator arm it. And so you can help with impunity in those circumstances.
In the larger point here, these teams both have pretty similar records. I think the Celtics were at 16-12 coming in, then were 16-13. Celtics have been much better during the season so far in terms of their fundamentals. And especially when you consider that their whole team was injured for about 3 weeks early in the season, they've been much better. Fifth in defense, I think you noted for the game.
Yeah.
Since Horford and Crowder came back. And that's more what we expected to see from the team. They were awful early on in this one. Isaiah Thomas missed some time a little bit ago as well with that groin injury. And, you know, they have like a 2.0 net rating. That's probably on the upswing. Whereas the Knicks, much worse point differential than their record. I think they had like a negative 2.9 net rating coming in. And so, you know, that's why this was a 50-50 game, even though New York was playing at home. And I think Boston just simply looked like a much better team than New York in this one. And especially because New York, just in a game like this, where Boston has these shooting bigs, New York has nobody to guard any big who...
They don't have a lot of counters because they don't have bigs who can defend in space and they don't have enough wings. So
yeah, I mean, like Lance Thomas has the plantar fasciitis. He was limping around in the first half, didn't come in again. Kuzminskas can shoot the ball, but he's pretty horrible defensively. Porzingis, really slow guarding on the perimeter at this point, even at center. He can be effective. Like when he was guarding Amir Johnson, he was really good protecting the rim during that run that they had. But as long as you have someone who can shoot that he has to guard, he's not going to be able to guard the three-point line and the rim simultaneously.
They just, with the personnel they have, it's always going to be a struggle. Also, the fact that they have in their guard rotation, well, unless you're really high on Justin Holiday, they really have Courtney Lee defensively, and that's a lot of it. And offensively, they have good guys, but it's not conducive to necessarily those dominant stretches. And so they'll have some nice runs like that 9-0 push, but they're gonna have some lulls in almost every game, and you're gonna have to survive that. The fortunate thing for them is that they do have two solid point guards, and they're getting more out of Jennings and Rose combined than I think most of us, including myself, expect.
Yeah, give us a few more Periscope questions too, general NBA topics, even if you want to. We're gonna finish up with this game in the next couple of minutes. Kelly Olynyk and Marcus Smart, I thought both had pretty close to what I would consider their best games of the season. Smart shot the ball well. We know he had that big shot.
Nice
at the
passes
end.
Too.
Yeah, he was able to get into the post. He actually played backup point guard over Rozier. Steven said after the game the reason for that was they wanted Smart in the post against Brandon Jennings, who is very slight of build, and usually Smart will play as more of a backup two or three, but he did play point guard in this one and was really able to do well. Had seven assists, I would guess guess that's probably a season high for him. And then Olynyk, 7 of 9 from the field, 16 points, 2 of 3 on threes. He's also effective getting into the post against mismatches, and he really stressed out those Knicks bigs who can't defend in space.
A major benefit for Boston of getting everyone back is that it also excised some of the problematic parts of the rotation. So just think about their big men now. So instead of relying a lot on Tyler Zeller, who had pretty much kind of played himself out of a spot in the rotation, they can give heavy minutes to Amir Johnson. They don't need him as much, but Al Horford. And then also you have Olynyk and Jonas Ripko, who can play a little bit at the four. And so you just don't need as much traditional bigs. And against teams that can't defend in space, why use
them? The Knicks, 17 turnovers in this one. The Celtics getting back, forcing turnovers. And then also one of the underrated things about Isaiah Thomas, he has a single-digit turnover rate, which is really incredible considering how much he handles the ball. And overall, the Celtics only had 6 turnovers. That a major problem for the Knicks defense. And there's really nobody on this team. Rose has always been a really low steal guy. Courtney Lee, more of a solid position guy. Melo doesn't get any steals. You know, Porzingis will get a few blocks, but there's really nobody on this team who's a ball hawk that makes opposing offenses.
You could conceive of a Knicks team that had a second unit that was more of a blitzing group that would do well with that, but that's just not who they have at this moment.
Yeah, I think Crowder was excellent as well. He had that personal 9-0 run as they surged out to the lead in the second quarter, and he did well on Melo, who was a mere 9 of 24 from the field. He did have a 15-point third quarter, but aside from that, really had a bit of an ugly morning.
Was there anything from this game that you particularly, I mean, we talked about the general dynamic of the Celtics just being a little bit better, but is there anything that you took away from it that you didn't expect going in?
I don't think so. I think it was just the Knicks defense is bad. I think we're expecting that. They're 25th in the league in defensive efficiency. That was something I think just the encouraging performances from Smart and Olynyk would be something.
That's where I was going to go.
We're not going to go crazy on that, but if they can get that regularly, then maybe the Celtics can separate themselves from that morass below Toronto and Cleveland.
Getting into a 7 or 8 guy group that they can trust. And also both those players have had a history of starting at various moments for the Celtics due to injuries. They're coming off the bench now. Both are playing with a lot of money on the line, and that they've been able to, that they can have a good game in a pretty high stakes performance. Good job.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting with the Linux C. He's going to have a little bit higher of a cap hold now. Celtics are going to be pressed for space as well this offseason just due to the minimums being higher. If they want to create max space, they basically are going to have to get rid of him. We'll see whether they have someone that they think can be better than him, what kind of contract could get. He certainly is someone that might be gettable in free agency. Let's talk a little bit about that Rose trade with Robin Lopez. Now, you were critical of that trade when it happened. I thought it was actually pretty good. Where do you stand on it now as we're 30 games in?
A big part of the reason I was critical of that trade, the Knicks clearly needed a point guard, and the market for long-term buys at that position was really bad. So that was part of your logic for it. And I agreed with it then. I stand by it. But I was higher on Robin Lopez, I think, than you were. And Robin Lopez has been better than I thought he was going to. He's had a really wonderful year. Defensively, he's getting more comfortable offensively. And the best part about him on his contract, though it's not really a big value contract unless he plays as awesome as he has so far, is that he was good enough to be a value, but not so dominant that if Porzingis ever was able to overtake him to be the center, that he would be that would impact your planning. Whereas Noah, because of the money and everything else, I was concerned about that. They hadn't signed him obviously yet, but that was the thing that concerned
me. Yeah, I mean, that, like, you have to view those things in isolation. Like, if I knew that signing Noah was part of the deal, I would have been a lot lower on it. I think Rose has surpassed both of our expectations.
Absolutely.
Did you say that so far?
Oh, yeah.
Now, whether he's going to keep shooting 40%, over 40% on all these mid-rangers is a question, but he's clearly been the Knicks' third best player.
Well, and it was a flyer for them because they punted on getting a long-term point guard this year, and if you look at kind of where
their
that
point guard
was,
situation trash too. Like, and I think if they had just signed some stopgap center instead of Noah, and like he, and imagine like if they had both Rose and then like that Noah money coming off the book this summer as well, having had a successful season, they are on track to make the playoffs. Whether they will still is another question. Some of these East got to start playing better at some point. The other thing that nobody, there are other components of that too. It wasn't just Rose for Lopez. It was also Justin Holiday, who they've got, they needed more wings. They've gotten cheap production out of him. He's basically making the minimum. Jerian Grant has been terrible so far from the Bulls. He was supposed to be part of this, and he was old as a rookie. He's going to be, I think, 24 already, or will turn so very soon. And then they also dumped $7.7 million in absolute dead money of Jose Calderon, which the Bulls then had to give up 2 second-rounders to Lakers so they could sign Dwayne Wade. So he people forget about that aspect of the trade as well, that they basically got, you know, $7 million free there. And just to get Rose on a one-year $20 million deal when your biggest need was point guard, and there's nobody else that you could have signed for that short that would have even been remotely competent. Jennings, for everyone's like, oh, hey, they got Jennings for 1 year, $5 million. Well, Jennings been terrible for them.
Knowing on Rose is worth, I mean, unless Lopez keeps at this level, knowing on Rose is worth that, because it's such a long-term structural thing, because Kristaps Porzingis cannot have the, he can't generate that much offense with the ball in his hand. And if that's true, you need somebody else to do that. And that is your biggest need when you're using him as kind of the linchpin of your team. So if that's Derrick Rose, you got him for very little. If it's not Derrick Rose, you know that, then you need to spend your $20 million or so in a different way. The Knicks still have all of that in place. And I agree with you that it's a little bit unfair to bring up Noah, though it was a concern of mine just because of the way this team is structured from a front office perspective.
One view that I've heard that I wanted to push back on a little bit is this idea that there's so many point guards in the league that, you know, you don't really need to worry about acquiring a point guard. And, you know, there's probably about 20 real decent starting point guards in the league. And that's very deep. You know, at the top, the position is very deep. If you don't have a good point guard, you are screwed, unless you have like a LeBron James, James Harden type of player next to him. Because, you know, compared to at center, I think like the Knicks, you saw how bad the Knicks were. Point guard torpedoed their season last year. Point guard torpedoed the Jazz season last year. If you don't have a solution at that position, it takes a lot to acquire one. Like, you're going to need to spend $15 million, if not more, to get one. And well, to get Rose the way they did was useful, right?
And look at what the Jazz did. So the Jazz gave up a lottery pick, and they're going to have to spend a ton of money to keep him. And they also have thrown other picks at the problem. Dante Exum, they used I think it was the fifth pick in the draft. They used that on him. And
talking about re-signing George Hill, right?
Re-signing George Hill. Yeah, exactly. But so they've used a lot in that way. It looks like if he can ever get on the floor, that it's going to be worthwhile. But we also saw it with teams. I like that you went on the high scale with the Jazz, but the Brooklyn Nets, both last year and then this year when Jeremy Lin had his hamstring injury, they've had two seasons where they've basically been completely derailed by that. Yeah. You need someone who can get stuff started, who can generate looks for other players, because as wonderful as NBA talent is, that's not a common skill set. Most players at this level against great defenses and good coaching need somebody who can create the seam that they can use. That's why LeBron is so valuable. That's why so many other guys. And if you don't have that guy, you can see it from a mile.
All right, this will be our last question here. You can close on this one. Grant Farmer 10, what kind of contract does D. Rose sign this offseason? And we'll make the assumption, by the way, that he just continues to play at about this level, you know, plays 70 games, which would be a minor miracle for him.
I would not give him this contract, but if I had to ballpark it right now, I'd say something around 3 years, $45 million. That's like...
You wouldn't give him... I would give him that contract.
Well, it would depend on how...
For 3 years, $45 million? Like, that, as a guy who just is even like a lower-end starter, I think that's fine. And it, like, it's when you're doing the 4 years or the 5 years for him that you really... It's the... This is one of your years, not dollars things. That's
yes,
one
it
of your
is.
Favorite phrases. I think it's going to be one of those. I don't know. I think he could be like 3 years, six something.
Oh,
I mean, and, well, here's the thing too. Like, it depends whether he comes back to the Knicks, how successful this Knicks season is too, and what other options the Knicks have. There's a lot of players are going to be returning to their teams with the new rules.
Yeah,
now.
He's also a player that has constituencies and front offices all around the league. Rose is a player who won an MVP. We see that with guys like Jeff Green or various players who've been good at a stop or two, that people like them and want to coach them. And he's a name, absolutely, for sure.
Okay, we'll get to the last three games momentarily, but first, this from Capital One. Capital One knows you've got questions about your credit. You may be asking, who's really in charge of my credit score? Or how does my credit score actually work? That's why Capital One created the CreditWise app, so you can check your credit score anytime you want right in the app. And it's free to everyone, Capital One customer or not. In fact, millions of CreditWise users have improved their score by 20 points or more, so download the app for free today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank, USA, NA. All right, Danny, let's move on to the last three games of the Christmas slate. Any of these particularly compelling to you?
I think we should start with Wolves Thunder. To me, it was the most interesting of these games, even though a lot of that was just Russell Westbrook being ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. And one of the concepts that I took away from both this game and the Clippers-Lakers games, although the Lakers actually ended up winning, was there are certain players to me, and part of it's not even necessarily their fault, it's just the teams that they are on or the schemes that they're in or their particular skill set are are really bellwethers for whether the defense that they are playing against is good or not. And what Russell Westbrook was able to do, what Enes Kanter and Steven Adams were able to do, Kanter mostly creating his own offense, Adams mostly benefiting from what Westbrook was able to set up, putting up the efficient 30 points and 15 assists that Westbrook had in this one on outstanding shooting from the field by his standards, 11 of 25 and then 8 of 9 from the free throw line for that 31 points. I think a lot of that is just defenses that are young, that are inexperienced, are really going to struggle against Russ, whereas even teams that have a better plan, Golden State, Utah, even Portland to some extent, just because they're able to pack the paint against Russ, are able to have a lot more success stopping him, whereas this Thunder team, even with Victor Oladipo now missing his seventh straight game with a sprained wrist, did not have any kind of success stopping this Thunder squad.
So much of what Oklahoma City did well in this game was predicated on Westbrook's dribble penetration. And so what happened was he would get into the lane, usually have a step on his guy, and then the Minnesota big man would have to make a decision. And a lot of times they were playing him for the shot, completely understandable considering Russell Westbrook. And that gave him the perfect window to make passes, particularly to Steven Adams.
Steven Adams, and then the other play that they ran really as a set play many a time, I think they got three of these in this, was the pick and roll and then have the lob for either Jeremy Grant or Andre Robertson coming in from the corner where their guy wasn't really guarding him and was trying to get in and help on the pick and roll. They got Andrew Wiggins with that quite a few times. So that's another very kind of basic action. They weren't doing a good enough job of guarding the pick and roll. One thing Westbrook was really successful at was going really before even the screener had arrived. And he's just got that one move, foot on the gas acceleration, to blow by his man at the point of attack. And so what that would cause is usually you'll have the screener run up and then the guy guarding him will follow and kind of be in position to guard the pick and roll once the screen takes place. With Westbrook hitting the accelerator right away, he could catch the screener's man still running up towards the three-point line, and then there's no way that guy was going to be able to turn around and get back into help position. So he was able really to beat two guys just by beating his own man as the screener was running up.
My feeling watching this was that Westbrook's shots, in terms of the looks themselves, were not substantially better than usual. He maybe a little bit lighter contested, but he just did a better job of making them. But also it was fueled by his passing, which was the bigger star to me.
Yeah, and I mean, you got to really, Westbrook is one of these things where you got to take away one of his two things, right? I mean, any competent defense should be able to take away one of those two things. And obviously, he's a great player, but he's not surrounded by a ton of shooting talent on this team. Although they have had a renaissance, or I should say a sance, because this is the first time we've seen him in the NBA, from Alex Abrines, who really has to be guarded up by the three-point line. They started Morrow. He barely played, actually, only played 12 minutes. Sabonis, he's getting guarded a little bit more at three. We saw Karl Towns, who had a very poor defensive game, not willing to help off of Sabonis after Sabonis, I think in the game before this, went like 4 of 5 from three or 5 of 5, something like that. Joffrey LaVerne was 2 of 2 on three. So they managed to space the floor a little bit better, but it really was still the primary action. It was only 8 out of 24 on threes for Oklahoma City.
Did you see that LaVerne spin move from the basically from a little bit below the top of the key?
That's one that I can't bring to mind actually right now.
It was I was just sitting there going, he is a skilled guy, but he shouldn't be able to pull that off without getting like ripped or something else like that, because he's not that good. He's good, but not that good.
Yeah, the other thing that was really disappointing defensively for the Wolves, what was not disappointing was their awesome Christmas uniforms that are way better. Actually, yeah, the three teams with the worst uniforms in these games, the Clippers and the Thunder and the Wolves, all had substantial upgrades over their normal uniforms with the Christmas uniforms. Enes Kanter, 8 out of 10 from the field, also got to the foul line for 7 attempts. And for him to put up 20 points on 13 shooting possessions like that, he was plus 17, usually not a plus minus all-star by any means, but that's really where Oklahoma City won this game, was against the Wolves' putrid bench. That bench, other than Shabazz Muhammad getting a few points, especially late, again, really struggled. They went to Jordan Hill, really, for the first time this year. He, of course, you know, isn't any good. Bielitsa was outclassed once again. Chris Dunn didn't really do much. He only had 3 points in his 17 minutes. And it really was Kanter just going into the post. He even was, like, diming guys up. Kanter had 4 assists. That's got to be, like, close close to a career high for him. He was totally beasting Gorky Dang in the post. He was beasting Hill. And really, just again, with cancer and not amazing shooting around him, that's not something that a competent defense should struggle against. And that's something that, in fact, Oklahoma City has usually struggled with for most of the year when you've got him surrounded by guys like Samaje Christen and Jeremy Grant, who can't shoot at all.
It was a major problem, and it is strange that we've gone this long without talking about Towns, who I felt was disappointing overall in this game.
Yeah, you don't want to say that necessarily, and remember, these are young guys. He had 26 points.
He wasn't bad, he was just disappointing.
Yeah, defensively, the effort just wasn't good enough. He was either stuck to shooters too much, he was not getting back in transition. You know, there was one notable play where he just faced up on Steven Adams, and it actually had a lot of success driving to the basket against Adams. His posting up Adams, I mean, Adams is a big burly guy, and Towns was able to just knock him back, get to his jump hook at times. But he also really settled for some bad two-point jumpers, bad threes that were contested, and then he just on the game really sealing play that put them up and got the reserves in, he just sauntered back on D after taking a jumper, and Adams sprinted back. They were even at the start of the play, and Westbrook pushed the ball and just found Adams, I think, for an alley-oop that, and Towns was like totally out of the picture by the end of the play. Just a lot of plays like that where we didn't see the level of effort that you're really going to need to see from Towns if this team is going to get to where it needs to defensively, because I think the offensive talent is there. They just fix the bench a little bit. They're good on that because that's really their problem. They can't score with that bench, but they just have to get more out of Towns defensively, and Gorgui Dieng was really no better.
It would have been a better option to have an improved plan on dealing with the Thunder. I think back to that Blazers-Thunder game where they just had a scheme, executed it, and the Thunder couldn't really get much out. But you can make it work against a limited squad with effort and just kind of the right personnel, and Minnesota wasn't making anything particularly hard. And while Towns is not the reason that happened, he could have helped more than he did.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just his pick and roll defense was not good. His help was not very good. You know, they didn't really do any switching at all in this game. They didn't do any blitzing of those Westbrook pick and rolls either. I still haven't seen a single team really try that yet.
Yeah,
and maybe it's because they believe just that like Westbrook is so fast and so dominant that he's just gonna like beat the trap, and then it's gonna, you know, then it's a 5-on-3. But you know, I'd like to see somebody try it at least. In the Wolves with Towns especially have guys with the foot speed to maybe pull that off.
Do you want to get into your Wiggins Levine thing?
Yeah, I do. Let's save that for the end. Actually, I wanted to get to a few more notes, one of which was that how impressed I was with Towns getting into the post, and yet another reason why I think that you know, Towns's jump shot is great, but him being able to really beast guys in the post, even true centers like Steven Adams, that's really curtailed by the fact that Rubio can't shoot at all. The Thunder weren't guarding him at all. Dunn can't shoot at all either, if you want to go with him. And then they've got Gorgui Dieng, who doesn't space the floor really to three, has a little bit slower of a release than you'd expect or really like someone of his ilk to have, even though he shoots a high percentage. So again, I was just becoming frustrated with the fact that they don't have any kind of a reasonable stretch four option on this squad. And Bielitsa, you know, he just again was bad. Like, you know, seeing him, he like caught the ball with LaVerne closing out on him and like wasn't able to blow by Joffrey LaVerne and finish a layup. You know, it really was just Bielitsa's athleticism is really what's holding him back right now as an NBA player.
Also fuels the idea that he shouldn't be playing small forward at all, which has been something Tibbs has gone to at certain moments this season.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's probably gotten more at power forward throughout most of the season. But yeah, I mean, he's just, and Bielitsa is a great playmaker at the European level. European fours, when he plays the four, really struggle to deal with him. But the NBA is not Europe, and it's not FIBA basketball either. And so if he's going to be running pick and rolls, and he's also doesn't shoot the ball well enough from three either. I mean, that's his other problem. Hasn't shot well enough from NBA three. You could just switch those pick and rolls even with a big man. He's not going to be able to beat that guy, you know, because LaVerne is probably a below average big man moving his feet, and he's still able to stay with him as just an example here.
You talked about it a little bit just in terms of personnel, but Minnesota only attempted 12 threes in this game, and that feels impossible in today's NBA, even if you have inferior talent. We talked about it a little bit when we did Knicks Celtics as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're just getting think of who's going to be taking the threes other than just Zach LaVine pulling up. He was 3 out of 5 on threes on his pull-ups. Towns, who, yeah, he can take those every once in a while, but unless you're running a specific play for him, he's not going to be spaced out. He's going to be part of the primary action. Wiggins, again, not a guy who's really going to be spotting up on this team. And then you have the other two guys. We've talked about this in the 15 and 60, where your two support players around those three, neither of them took a three-pointer in this game. In fact, outside of the big three, the entire team was 1 for 3 on three-pointers in total. I mean, you have to get some role players who can make a shot on this team.
Now do you want to get into it?
Yeah, I do. And my last little note too is one of the things that Billy Donovan has been doing that I have not really cared for, that actually paid off for him and when Samaje Christen made a three, I think at the end of the first quarter, but he will just put his bad offensive players in end of game, end of quarter situations. Like, he had Christen and Andre Roberson in the game at the end of the first quarter, like with Westbrook, I think too, was out there. And it's just like their free throw shot right before that, just sub the guys out, man. Like, put in Morrow, put in Abrines. There's somebody who can shoot the ball. I mean, like, Phil Jackson's been doing that, was doing that in 1991. Like, you should be able to figure that one out.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah. So I tweeted during the game, and this is interesting considering it was only really a week and a half ago that we did our best prospects list, and we had Wiggins at what, like number 5 or 6, and Zach LaVine was honorable mention. But I actually said I think that LaVine is going to be better than Wiggins, which is a surprise because Wiggins got 8 free throw attempts, was 10 to 20 from the field in this one, and LaVine was negative 21. A lot of that compiled with that putrid bench unit. But I think Wiggins has the higher ceiling, but I think that LaVine has the higher median outcome because he just can get out in transition. He can make threes. He's got a high usage rate, 600 true shooting percentage already. Better rebounder, probably better at getting steals than Wiggins is. Probably not as good of an individual defender, but you're still not quite seeing it yet from Wiggins in terms of like his floor game and his feel for the game. And so I just think other than scoring, there's just not going to be anything that Wiggins is going to do well. Whereas LaVine, I trust him more to fill into a role on a team.
Plug and play is exactly where I was going to go with that. And it's part of the reason why I liked LaVine as a draft prospect, because plug and play is nice, but it's way better at a position of need and a position of scarcity, which shooting guard is. So you could use him in a variety of capacities on a variety of teams. Whereas Wiggins, if you throw him in, he's kind of going to Andrew Wiggins it up. It's a criticism I've had of Rudy Gay and actually Rajon Rondo at various moments, which is that they are good players and there are many teams where them being on it improves the situation, but it probably gives the team a lower ceiling. Now, Wiggins can outperform that.
That's a great point.
He's still young. He can get a lot better than that, but it's also compounded, so this offensive limitation with him, with the lack of defensive ceiling. He's had some really nice moments, certainly. I'm not trying to say he's a bad defender all the time or anything like that, but you reach a point where, and he's in his third year, and he has a great defensive coach, and I want to give him time, where you start to lose the benefit of the doubt. That doesn't mean it's a death sentence or anything like that, but you lose the benefit of the doubt, and that's where I'm getting with him.
Yeah, in this game, there's no one for him to guard is like, I'm gonna just guard you only and lock down. And just his ability to help and recover and be a force on the boards, be a force and help defense, block some shots, protect the rim, just not there at all. I mean, just like a guy like Kawhi Leonard, to whom, you know, you thought that Wiggins might be able to be defensively when he was drafted, that guy is able to make plays in the floor game playing help defense. That's just not something that Wiggins can do. And you mentioned Rudy Gay. It's like, all right, you know, is this guy going to be able to be efficient as a scorer? Like, how far are you really going with this guy as your number one option on the perimeter? And if he's not good enough to be that, then his other weaknesses are so bad. I mean, you know, maybe he can help you win 40 games, but can he help you win 50 games playing the role that he really kind of needs to play? That's an open question. Whereas LaVine, you know, just his ability to take some, you know, pull up, get his three pointers, get out in transition, score efficiently. I think all of that is, you know, he's not being guarded by the best wing defender on the other team or anything like that. But I think just his ability to rise up and get that three pointer off accurately is just such a great skill in today's league. All right, let's
I want to say one more thing.
Oh yeah, you got more here? Yeah, sorry.
The floor game issue is also becoming there. So we gave Wiggins a lot of latitude early in his career. He was playing a weird weird role on a strange team. His assist rate has barely risen over the couple of years. Like, his assist percentage has gone from just under 10% to just over 10%. His steal rate is lower than it has ever been. His block rate is lower than it has ever been. And the idea was, oh, he'll add some of that kind of stuff. He can make it better. And there are guys who have done that, but he hasn't, even though his role in the offense has increased. And theoretically, his defensive awareness, like his experience has helped, but we haven't seen that transmute itself in terms of those percentages. And there's a lot more to defense than those numbers, but it's another sign that he hasn't improved as much as we wanted.
Yeah, as I said, this is not clear cut to me at all. Wiggins still has the higher ceiling. That's kind of why I would almost have him still higher on that prospect list. But in terms of the median outcome, this is the first time today I was like, all right, you know what? I think I prefer Levine. It's surprising because Wiggins, in theory, outplayed him today. Should we move on to the Bulls and Spurs?
Sure, let's do it.
So the Bulls did fight back in this game, but it was a desultory start, down 26-8, a desultory end as well. Both teams really hit the offensive glass in this one. 38% offensive rebounding for San Antonio and 36% for Chicago. The Bulls defense was putrid in this one. They actually scored well enough despite their usual spacing problems. 131 offensive rating, 119 points on a very slow, only 91 possessions. So really just carving up the Bulls. And while Robin Lopez has played well this season, and the Bulls have done a good job of putting him in position to succeed where he doesn't have to get out on the pick and roll, the shooting provided by the Spurs bigs really put him in a bind in pick and roll defense. For some reason, they started him on LaMarcus Aldridge, maybe because he just used to guard him in Portland, and Hoiberg thought he would be a good matchup on LaMarcus in the post. But they just, you know, trail two-point jumper, drag screen and transition, and LaMarcus started 9 for his first 9 from the field, much of it just catch and shoot jumpers at Lopez's expense. And Lopez was not helped by the fact that Tony Parker was being guarded by Rondo. Parker would just roll around the screen, Lopez would have to help, and then they just throw right back out to the top to Aldridge for a money two-point jumper that he's been making since 2006.
Those big long twos were also a factor in something that was crazy for me in this game, which is that the teams combined for 4 block shots, and there a lot of that was due to various things. I actually am a little bit surprised that the Spurs only had 3 compared to the Bulls with 1, just with the way that it was kind of shooting out. But this game fed into a lot of the concerns that we had about Chicago's defense going in. Those have not manifested nearly as much as either of us expected, to their credit as a team in terms of effort, but it was a reminder that they have flaws that can be exploited.
Yeah, and this is a team that exploited them. Offensively, they are able to exploit those flaws as well, and packing the paint, forcing the Bulls to beat them from the outside. Nikola Mirotic was 3 out of 6 on threes, but nobody else in this team got up more than 3. And Jimmy Butler found the going extremely difficult, obviously guarded by Kawhi Leonard a lot of the time. Then they put Danny Green on him in the second half. And the bigger problem, too, of course, was that Rondo wasn't being guarded. I mean, by the third quarter, after the Bulls just couldn't score at all in Rondo's first stint, when they also went with the two bigs, obviously Lopez and Gibson, the third quarter was basically every play was being run involving Rondo as a screener, or with him in the ball with the ball in his hands, or having him do some kind of a set play with the cut to just find a way to force San Antonio to guard him. There was really no flow to Fred Hoiberg's offense in that third quarter, and they actually were effective for a time in coming back to take a brief lead. And then at the end of the third quarter, Dwayne Dedmon came in, David Lee was killing also, and Lopez really again started getting taken advantage of in pick and roll defense. The Spurs went on a 12-0 run at the end of the third quarter to take control, and were basically up by 10 for the rest of the game. And they're up by 10 for most of the game too. The Bulls just managed to come back early in the third quarter.
Is it worth picking on Jerian Grant, or is he just in kind of an unwinnable situation because they need him to play more than he should play?
Well, he's supposed to be able to play. He was the number 19 pick. He's old. If he's going to be a decent backup, you probably would have hoped that it would have happened by now. He just is not shoot well. He hit a desperation three, I think, at the end of the first quarter. But other than that, did little in this one. He was negative 10. Rondo was negative 9. Neither of them really contributed. Rondo, 6 points and 2 assists in this game. Really not very impressive at all, as the Spurs did a good job of taking away what he was trying to do. Yeah, I mean, maybe Michael Carter-Williams is going to help. I mean, I think there's no way that Carter-Williams could be worse than what Rondo has given them so far on either end. He still is a terrible fit, just like the rest of these dudes, because they can't shoot. And it's really the fit issues in the starting lineup. I understand why Hoiberg starts the guys that he does, because Mirotić has played poorly enough to even get out of the rotation for a brief period. Lopez is their best center. So, you know, Gibson is better than Mirotić. McDermott probably isn't as good, obviously, as Wade or Butler, and he's not a point guard. But they have to start one of those guys, or they're just not ever going to have enough shooting. And then the problem compounds when you go to the bench and you bring in Mirotić and McDermott together, and now you can't stop anybody.
It's a problem we've talked about with the Spurs before, with their current roster that was never an issue before.
You know, that's right. Because, and Parker, who actually finished 6 of 15, it was funny listening to the broadcast. There was an interview that was done off air with Pop, in which Pop said, "Hey, Tony, you know, we need him to play more like Steve Nash these days. Just, you know, take his corner three, take his elbow jumper, and other than that, just penetrate and look to find people." But Parker has never really quite had that kind of vision. He did have 8 assists in this one, but 4 turnovers. He's never really been a high assist guy. He likes to get to the basket and score. And then Gasol as well. I mean, this was a Bulls team, though, that's not going to stress those guys defensively due to their own lack of spacing.
Yeah, you're going to rely on Rondo to exploit Tony Parker. It's not going to happen a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, and it's also worth remembering, too, while Butler is in a much more difficult situation to succeed, that Kawhi Leonard really is just, you know, Kawhi Leonard is a top five level of player in the NBA, and Jimmy Butler, while he had a nice start to the year, it is not that. He is not Kawhi Leonard's equal on either end, in my opinion. And Kawhi, though, he and LaMarcus both played 38 minutes, which is a lot for a Pop coach team. Kawhi is just so much more efficient than Butler. He can get to his shot. He's longer. He's bigger. He's stronger. Although Butler is incredibly strong himself. And also just has much better hands defensively, better three-point shooter. He's really better than Butler in just about every single possible area.
And that's no shame on Jimmy Butler. It's just that Kawhi's a monster.
Yeah, I mean, Butler is a top 15 type of player, and Kawhi Leonard is a top 5 type of player. We just happen to kind of have 7 of those in the league right now, or 6 of them. All right, I think that's, I guess the other thing I have on this one is just the Spurs have done a great job getting a lot out of David Lee in this. You know, they go with 2 bigs off the bench. A lot of times it's Lee and Dedmon together, and Lee just had an efficient 9 points on 4 of 5 from the field. Dedmon also was 4 of 5 for 9 points. And when you throw those guys in with Mills, maybe Leonard will get some minutes with them also. Manu, John Simmons, like all those guys really have been fantastic. And Lee has been efficient once again, hasn't been getting killed defensively, and just a great reclamation project, especially because you thought that he was useless really offensively unless he was playing as a traditional center. And the Spurs have been able to get enough out of him really playing at the power forward that he played for so many years rather than center as the role man. And then that helps him avoid getting exposed so badly on defense.
Especially on the defensive glass, because Dedmon can be a talent on that end, and he had a good defensive rebounding game here. Lee is also an intelligent passer who can make the right decision. Playing him with other guys who do similar things, it works within not only what he is good at, but things he has already done in his playing career.
The Bulls now 14-16 after that very encouraging start, and San Antonio 25-6, ho-hum, just rolling along. They're actually only one game behind the Warriors now in the loss column, although I don't expect them necessarily to compete for that number one seed throughout the course of the season. I mean, I think the net rating for the Warriors is like double what the Spurs is right now.
And that ties in with the other game that we haven't discussed, because the Spurs are also now 3 games ahead of everyone else in the West in the loss column at this point.
Yeah, with the Clippers now, injury issues. Chris Paul missed this one. He's likely to miss the next two. Also tried to warm up and give it a go. Initial reports in this Lakers Clippers game were that he was going to play. Then he got scratched after that, I guess, due to a warm-up that didn't go very well. JJ Redick had to leave the game with hamstring tightness. We know where Blake Griffin is. He's going to miss, you know, 6 weeks at a minimum, you would think. So with that all being the case, the Spurs having that 3-game lead, they also are, I think, much more able to withstand injury injuries, just due to their system and their depth, than all of these other teams. Who do you think is the biggest threat to them in the number two seed right now?
Houston? I mean, they've put it together.
I mean, they got their own injury problems with Capella, too. You know, I mean, it's really hard to find a challenger.
Yeah, the Spurs are...
And Utah just lost three straight.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenge there. And the Clippers, they're dealing with a lot of stuff right now. But I was sitting there watching that third quarter and just thinking, this team's going to struggle to win games if they can't put it together in that way, because their offense looked so disjointed. And then the Lakers were getting everything they wanted. They were getting tip-ins. They were getting clean looks at three. And the Clippers obviously are far and far away from what they are at their best. But a regular season record is about, you know, putting it together, and you can have some throwaway games. And they had this not by choice, but by fate. But they are going to need to minimize that, not only to compete for the two seed, but to hold on to the three.
Yeah, that's right. You'd have to think that Houston is looking like the favorite right now for that number three seed. That's going to be coveted real estate, as we know, to stay out of the Warriors bracket. This game featured the other player that I mentioned as we started this segment on these last three games. JJ Redick is somewhat of this bellwether for your defense maybe not being that good, especially when you look at Chris Paul being out and Blake Griffin being out. There's not really that much else going on to where you're going to need to help off of Redick. And I think he still had 19 points in the first half, as the Lakers defense, one of the worst in the league, wasn't able to keep track of him. And then Redick suffered some hamstring tightness, didn't return in the fourth quarter, played a little bit in the third. And the Lakers, in a run that started at the end of the second, but mostly at the start of the third, an 11-0 run, they took control after trailing by 10 or so most of the first half. Most disappointing for the Clippers, and this is what you alluded to, is just, you know, only 102 points on 98 possessions in this one, 104 offensive rating against the worst defense in the league or thereabouts. That's not going to get it done, but that's what happens when all of your good offensive players are injured.
And it's also what happens when you give Austin Rivers the ball in his hands a lot and play him 25 minutes.
Well, they don't have anyone else at this point. Right? I think it's just what's going to happen, which is not the greatest for them. Another disappointing aspect of this one was the Lakers destroying the Clippers on the offensive glass, 31% offensive rebounding, and Timofey Mozgov was outstanding in this game. DeAndre Jordan basically was not guarding him at all. Mozgov shot well from mid-range, 4 out of 6, also got on the offensive glass to get inside for some tip-ins, really made DeAndre Jordan pay for just simply not guarding him at all and trying to mess up all the Lakers' other actions.
It's becoming a little bit more concerning that big men who don't have a lot of stretch in their game but have enough are getting clean looks this reliably, especially when you consider that it's not like the Lakers are an offensive juggernaut. They're doing well with the personnel that they have, but if what you need against DeAndre is basically just to stretch him out and ideally not use that guy in the primary action of the play, guess what? A lot of the teams the Clippers are going to face in the playoffs can do that easily.
Yeah, and this was not a vintage DeAndre performance in terms of his effort. And, you know, these are the performances that when we talk about him being in that absolute upper echelon defensively, that, you know, on late at night on Christmas, it is Christmas, but not that many people were watching by the end, he was so bad. And the Clippers made a mild comeback with Spates at center that Doc Rivers, despite him being by far the best player available to him, didn't even go back to DeAndre Jordan at the end of the game. I didn't think that was the right decision. And that Spates led rally began to falter down the end, as I think they got back within like 6 or so at one point in the fourth before the Lakers restored order. So that's not too good. Only 28 minutes out of DeAndre in this one. And he actually, I don't think, didn't close one of the games earlier in the week as well. So there's 2 out of the last 3 that he has not closed. I'm not going to make too much out of that, but the idea that, you know, you're going to stop anybody with the most space at center, that's not going to happen either, even though he did have 15 points in this one.
I'm getting very, very close to, I wouldn't say retiring, but shuttering Spates threes versus Whiteside assists for a little while, because now it's 36 to 21 and Spates assists versus Whiteside assists is 25-21 in favor of Spates. So I don't know what to do with this anymore, and I love it way too much.
Yeah, that and the Church of Hazonia really of looking like they're gonna fall by the wayside for you.
It's been a wonderful season, but those two things are grave disappointments.
Talk a little bit more about the Lakers. They also got some nice defense out of Luol Deng. Deng starting to round into form a little bit athletically, had 5 offensive rebounds in this game, had a nice sequence where he blocked a bunch of shots on Mbamute, 2 steals also, 12 rebounds overall, got to the foul line for 7 shots. Really, it helps that the Clippers have no good wings for him to match up against. That was an assist, but 34 minutes for Deng. He continues to round into form, and he's actually, in December, he's been about what they kind of would have hoped to get from him, averaging around 11 points, decent shooting from the field. He's been playing the complement of minutes I think they envisioned for him, whereas obviously his October and November was really miserable. So that's encouraging for the Lakers. Julius Randle had 8 assists in this one. That was impressive. And he just, I continue to really like his handle at the power forward position. I mean, he is one of the few power forwards you'll see who really doesn't dribble defensively. Like, there are guys who can dribble the ball up, but as soon as a guard gets around them, they're not going to continue to try to make the play. They'll kind of like protect the ball a little bit and just veer off their attack. Whereas Randle, he thinks he can dribble around a guard, and most of the time he's right. And Brandon Ingram actually played a little bit better as well. He reached double figures for the first time in a while, I think, or at least, you know, had not been doing so very regularly.
Something I'm looking forward to with the Lakers the rest of this week is that, as you mentioned, Deng has had a nice game here against Mbamute. He has some real challenges because Tuesday they play the Jazz and on Thursday they play the Mavericks. So presumably that's going to be Gordon Hayward and Harrison Barnes, assuming they put Julius Randle on Dorian Finney-Smith or, you know, Dirk. We'll see how they handle that. But I want to see if Deng can really take on those assignments and do at least a solid job, because that can be a kind of a linchpin for any defensive success that they can have.
All right, I think we're about done here, unless you wanted to add anything else.
I do. There's one small point, and I hadn't thought about this until tonight, but it is extremely weird that some of the teams that play on Christmas have off until Wednesday. The Warriors are on that list there. I think there are 2 or 3 teams.
Yeah, well, they got to fly back from from the East Coast.
But then a series of teams play tomorrow. They play Monday. I think there are 3 or 4 of the Sunday teams that play there, and it seems like you can figure out a happy medium between those two things. Like, I think the Lakers are one of the only teams that plays Sunday, Tuesday instead of Wednesday or Monday.
Yeah, well, the whole league had off yesterday, so I think that's a big part of it. When you have an entire day off for the league, you're gonna have to, it's inevitably gonna lead to some back-to-backs.
Yeah. Oh, so we also congratulations forgot to talk Detroit about, yeah, congratulations yeah. Detroit, you're probably gonna get like half the Cavs.
Yeah, especially after Kyrie played 44 minutes and LeBron played 40. Nick Young, 5 of 7 on threes in this one, continues his outstanding shooting, team high plus 25, best on the team by 11 points, and 19 points for Young on only 10 shooting possessions in this game. Really another outstanding shooting game for him, and he's just continues to be a quality player. I mean, you'd put the odds in favor of him opting out at this point, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, he's only making like $5 million or something next year. He's going to be 31, I want to say.
And he should get years. 30, you know, wow. Like, that's what you're looking for him is, you know, getting a 3 or 4 year contract, even if the annual value is a little bit lower, though, because that's going to be an overpay in a spectacular way if it's what happens.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, but you get the feeling he wants to remain in LA. We'll see what happens there.
He can go back to the Clippers. Yeah. That worked well.
All right. Our transitions are poor here at 12:51 a.m. after 12 and a half hours of basketball. But thanks so much for staying with us. Belated Merry Christmas to all of you Dunktown listeners. We really appreciate your support. Don't forget about our sponsors, SeatGeek and Capital One today. And we will be back tomorrow. Not sure exactly what the topic is going to be yet, but should have a couple of fun episodes throughout the week for your listening pleasure. We'll talk to you all soon. Thanks again to Capital One's CreditWise app for sponsoring us today. Capital One created the CreditWise app so you can check your credit score anytime you want right in the app. It's free to everyone, so download CreditWise today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank USA, N.A.